We're late for a train. 53 years late.
People, they don't realise what they lost. Don't realise what they lost. My God of Almighty. The people were so happy, you know.
The Bundoran Express, it was called. A train carrying pleasure seekers and pilgrims. Bound for the sea and sand of Bundoran. And the fasting and prayer of Loch Derg.
Oh, I think it was the death knell for the town. In fact, I don't think the town has really ever recovered from it. It lost all its vibrancy and life whenever the railway closed.
It pulled out of Clonus Station in August 1957 and never returned. The end of the line came. The station's closed.
On occasion, there were something like 800 passengers got off the train to go to Loch Derg on one day. That's, you know, you can't replace that.
We set off on foot, 80 miles, in its wake, along its cuttings and embankments, in search of what happened it, its passengers and workers, the ghosts of men who built it, their stories.
There was nothing that had the same sort of social connections as the railway. The railway had railway families, people who had worked on the railway for generations. It was part of their culture and part of their life. And when those families all left, something left the town. Some spirit left the town at that stage, I think.
Three years on, there's not much left of it.
This is where the Bundoran Express became an animal that it was, taking passengers and pilgrims all the way west to Pettigo and Loch Derg and then on to Bundoran.
Yes, you wouldn't believe it now though. I wonder what we'll find on the way. We've got 80 odd miles until we get to the sea. Well, leaving here, we're going to head on up towards Enniskillen, on up past Loch Earn, up into a bit of Tyrone, and then up to Kesh, and up to Pettigo, and we stop at Loch Derg, and then Loch Derg, on to Ballyshannon, and ultimately our final destination, Bundoran. Before we leave Clonus, we have one whistle stop to make, to the home of 89-year-old Dan Kerr. Dan worked and travelled this line as an employee and as a passenger. He worked for 16 years with the Great Northern Railway.
When I started the railway as a boy porter, and it wasn't so bad, at an early late tour. I think it was about £2 a week or something. That'd be 1939. And then I got appointed then, because a lot of them left to join the army, Free State Army and the British Army and the railways, and I got appointed permanent then in 1941. And then the first appointment I got was on the lamps, the worst job in the railway. You had to walk out now, you know where the Cavan Bridge is there, way out the Duter Butler Road. You had to walk out as far as Lager Cross out there. You did home signal there. It was 50 foot. You had to go up a ladder twice a week, clean the glass of the signal, take out the cisterns, clean the lamp inside. You'd only an iron bar around you to keep you. And you're supposed to be going into, and you'd fill it. And then you had to walk from that into the Monaghan Road, that's at the Gala place. There was a bridge across there. And that was the worst one. I hated. There was the inner home was up there, and it was the same. But you looked down, you were looking down on the Monaghan Road, the cars got in and with that side, and you were swinging like that there. And I'd done that for one winter then. As regards trades to Bundoran, well, that was a regular place. It was a great place, and Bundoran was a marvellous time. After children made their communion or confirmation, the father and mother brought them to Bundoran for a day. You'd have four trades go to Bundoran for a day. Maybe one coming from Cavan, you might have one coming from Belfast, you might have one coming from Dundalk, you might have one, three to come from Clonus. So you could get an early train in the morning, late train at night. And some of the boys, it was adults that time, there was a great ballroom in O'Carr's ballroom. And the fellas would go early in the midday or that after dinner, and then they'd wait for the, go up to the ballroom and dance and come home in the late train.
So walking along an embankment here that's approximately 20 foot high, and to think all this would have been shoveled by hand with maybe only basic steam power for cranes and that. So we just continue and see where we end up.
Yep.
In a moment the line arrows out of dense undergrowth. We find ourselves in a deep cutting. Earth to our left and right rises steeply. Ahead of us, all the eye sees is the path the trains took. From another era, another country. Nothing mechanical has been through here in 50 years. I stand where once a steam train beat on through the miles, conveying people and their stories, dreams and hopes. It's like an outer body experience, but the body is the land itself. And one day, the trains came no more. The lines pulled up, the sleepers lifted. We walk until water tells us to find some other way to go. Following the route of the train, we arrive into Enniskillen. Where once the express thundered on, we have a stop to make. Headhunters is both a barber shop and railway museum. We meet Selwyn Johnson. He's trying his luck on a machine that will be familiar to the passengers of the 1950s express.
Actually won, and you won a penny and another go. So when you went to Bundoran, of course, you're going for the fun and enjoyment and excitement, and these types of machines you would have played when you'd got there, and there was no of the electronic games that you have today. So these were the sort of things you would have played, and you would have brought along your swimsuit. We have a woolen swimsuit here, that a lady's swimsuit that would have been worn. Quite uncomfortable, and you can imagine too, whenever a woolen swimsuit would get wet, it might just take a different shape altogether. But again, when you're going on the train, you would have had your suitcase that we have here, and had your swimsuit and everything else packed. And a journey to the seaside was something quite special. And I mean, you would have had Sunday school excursions, and kids, it was the highlight. And for kids today, it was probably similar to going to America or somewhere. Just to get to the seaside was just an extremely special event.
The other thing, I suppose, about a railway station, and at the time places like Enniskillen, there often would have been the last journey people would have made, maybe leaving the country or going away to war or different things.
That's right. And for some people it was that the farewells were a very sad place, where they had the farewells at the station, people going off to make a new life elsewhere, going off to get married, going off on honeymoon. So it was a point of happiness and also of sadness, and also of immigration, and I mean, it just was the central point of the community.
With the train crossing borders and frontiers, opportunities for smuggling were rife. During the war years, the Great Northern Railway operated so-called mystery trains from the north into the Free State. Passengers could purchase items and smuggle them back into the north. A cat and mouse game with the customs.
the mystery tours would have been mostly from Belfast, and of course people knew that the train was going down south. It was going where they could get a few items of duty-free items and bring them back, so it was well known, and of course the Great Northern, that was the reason why they were doing it, and they knew that it was a good chance to pick up on a lot of the produce that you couldn't get in Northern Ireland for a lot cheaper.
So the mystery really was...
The mystery was no mystery. People knew where it was going, but it was certainly well supported.
I see we have a price here for a mystery tour here. 1949, leaving Belfast. Described as through scenic districts in Northern Ireland and Era.
Yes, and people would have been very disappointed if it hadn't have reached Era. It would have been a riot on the train because they knew that that's why they wanted to go on it.
We leave Enniskillen behind. As a boy in the 1950s, Charles Friel travelled westward on the Bundoran Express. Now he's a steam enthusiast and member of the Railway Preservation Society. We catch him just as a train is being crushed. An old locomotive goes to the great engine shed in the sky.
Of course, there were people just going there was a lot of people who used the express as a way of getting to the west coast to get to Bundoran or Ballyshannon or, in my own case, to get to my mother's place in Sligo. That is that ordinary traffic. The pilgrimage traffic was big, there's no doubt. But outside of the peak seasons, I sometimes wonder just what the ratios were. We don't know. We know some of the big parties who went on the express to Pettigo to do the island, but what everybody else was up to, I don't know. The Great Northern ran a service which two carriages came from Dublin to Dundalk, another one was added there. It got to Clonus and a coach was added from Belfast, and those four coaches were then worked non-stop through Northern Ireland to avoid the customs to Pettigo. And that started back in 1831. And it was called Bundoran Express on the timetables, on the working timetables, but it didn't have a headboard the way the later train did. As you said, began in 1948. As a full-blown express all the way from Dublin, stopping only at Drogheda and Dundalk, and then heading across west from there. The whole thing dedicated to getting to Bundoran, sometimes five bogies, sometimes as few as three, and often as many as eight, and indeed sometimes running, the railroad described in duplicate, where you had two trains, both called Bundoran Express, one relieving the other, if you like, to just get the numbers moved. Which could be quite huge, especially in the early 50s.
Everything moved by rail at one time, and then that gradually disappeared. The days when we had several cinemas all showing different films, I mean, films moved from A to B by train, and they were delivered. The Great Northern, a lot of the railways were very good. They had a parcel service, which was a guy with a bike, who would have cycled from Enniskillen up the town to the Ritz Cinema or the Regal or whoever and deliver the films at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. They would have checked them ready for the show that night, and away they went. The next morning, back to Enniskillen, 9 o'clock, throw them in, they're now going to Monaghan or Emmy Vale or wherever, and off they went. Anything had to be moved, bread, sugar, seed potatoes, coal, all that heavy stuff, everything moved by rail at one time. Then that gradually disappeared. Even all the mail trains. I mean, the railway companies had big contracts from the post office and the Royal Mail to run postal services overnight and guaranteed deliveries. And hell take you if you delayed the mail, because it left Dunleary Pier in the morning at 6:30. It stopped briefly in Amiens Street. It was in Belfast for something like 9 o'clock. And in those days, you could get a letter from London delivered to your... There were four deliveries a day. Your letter delivered to your house, say, at 9:30. You could be darn sure that the reply letter would be on the ladies' table in London the next morning. But that huge system, it was huge in manpower and huge resources needed to... But then economics took over and the men in suits began doing sums and decided things weren't worth it. The poor old Great Northern, when the Irish North closed, there were all sorts of instructions sent out that every station to pack up all their furniture. all the clocks and all the tickets and everything they could think of and put them in carefully labelled boxes and send them off to Dundalk. The intention was that if we ever have to reopen the railway, we have all the kit here to do it. Mm. That lasted a couple of years later. I mean, the poor old Great Northern were quite sure the railway closed in 30 September 57. It wasn't until the 18th of September 57 that there was no more hope left. Mm. And finally the whole thing was going to have to close. Until then they were holding out hope against hope. I mean, they put on in a skill in the Belfast, they put on a rail car service that did the journey in no time at all compared to what the other connections had been. They put on all sorts of things to try and prove to the governments north and south that they knew how to cope with the new times that were coming. They were resolved they were going to close it.
Yeah.
I mean, the Northern even relayed around Bundoran Junction and all sorts of places, even Portadown, Armagh. A week before they closed, there were people earning overtime relaying the tracks, because the management thought, if we relay the tracks, they're going to say that, look, this is good for another 15 years for us, you don't have anything to it, just go run it.
So this is what's become of the Irish North, as the line was called by all the railway men, the men of the permanent way. Overgrown, ditches on either side.
The embankment gives way to the garden of a neat house. By today's standards, somewhere between modest and impressive. The path the trains took would have sent the engine hurtling somewhere into the sitting room and out the back kitchen, taking with it assorted furniture and appliances. In my mind, I wondered, does little Johnny, sitting on the carpet watching cartoons, know the great peril he is in? Better move, Johnny. The express stops for no one. A timetable has to be kept.
Before the railways came, every parish priest in Ireland decided what time it was, what time the engine was going to be rung at, because everywhere was different. And yet some PP in Clifney in County Sligo deciding that it was 22 minutes past Greenwich Mean Time, and the man in Clifton deciding it was 33 minutes past Greenwich Mean Time, whatever. But the railway came, that had to change, because you couldn't publish a local timetable. You had to say, we leave Dublin, and we had what was then standardised as Dublin time, or in many cases called railway time. And that became a standardised time right across. And we had, for a long, long time, we had Irish time and London time. So if you got off a boat in Larne Harbour, there was a clock with 2 minute hands, one for Dublin time, one for London time. One was 26 minutes behind the other. The railway in Dublin, the Great Northern, relied on knowing exactly when it was 9 a.m. in Dublin, in Main Street.
Mm.
The first train out of Dublin, the guard's watch was set to exactly 9 a.m. And every station he went to, he gave the time to the local station master, who adjusted his local clocks to make sure they were right. And that gradually spread, so by the time it got to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that time it trickled all the way through to Bundoran. And they would make sure their clocks were regulated. You know, such thing as listening to radio wearing and getting the pips. That was long, long before that. So that's how they did it.
We've got some really, really good walking done. A couple of miles through through some really, really picturesque embankments and cuttings and nature at its best. Broadleaf trees. And the going's good now. We're making good progress.
Without realising it, we crossed the frontier back into the Republic of Ireland.
Bah to you too.
The bridge is out?
Yeah, the bridge is blown.
The first person we meet is Aidan McGrath.
Fair old beams, isn't it?
Oh, jeez, I'm matey. Matey.
That's incredible.
They'd be there from day one, whatever that'd be, 1846, I think it was, or something like that. And all the sleepers and the track was actually gone.
Oh, they left it everything.
You never find anything lying around?
No.
Oh, jeez, you find on. They took everything. Because I asked the follow about that kind
of Aidan thing. Lives in the now restored Pettigo train station. He shows us around where once thousands of passengers and pilgrims waited to board the Bundoran Express.
listen, there is an outside stone wall there now.
So the workmanship in them is great, isn't it?
Well, that there, when I come in here first, that there was plastered up the same as that there, well, near enough.
Mm.
And I just took a hill there one day, the slaves, just to see what was on the time. I couldn't believe it, that it was all plastered over.
That's unreal.
Yeah. Was this an external wall? Or?
This was the waiting room. In here now, that there was the toilets in there. And this here was the waiting room, you stood here. I'll show you here then. That there rotted away about 20 years ago, I think, but everything else was all tuck, and they lifted the whole tracks.
Nice. You have a picture here of a train.
That's a picture of the train there, would have been outside, just on the platform there.
That train's the Bundoran Express.
Yeah.
That's fantastic history, yeah.
No, there's just out the front street there. Just out there, outside. Yeah. That's where we'll be all going heading for Lough.
Before we step onto the boat to the island, I remember what Dan Kerr told us, his memories of the Lough Derg experience.
Now, Lough Derg, the first time that I went to it was in the early 40s. It was nearly, the majority went, but they must have been worse than we were. It was all mostly women that go. And then maybe we'd have to give our bunks to them, please. And we'd have to sleep in the boathouse where they kept the big, big boats in the winter. Now, when we went across first, it wasn't organised the way it is now. It was flood zone, the boats, and we'd go across in that boat, and you'd be rowed across, and maybe the waves would come over, and whatever clothes you had, you were destroyed before you got there. And you had to sit out all night when you were doing the night vigil, and you had to sit out all night round and get whatever shelter you were. And it was hot weather, the midgets hit the face. Some of them have to be sent home, they come out in blisters. Or they come over in hives over from the forest. And the vigil at night was terrible, you know, from 12 o'clock at night to, you know, about 6 o'clock in the morning. And it was Monsignor Ward was on it. And he always gave a sermon in Irish. And sure, half the congregation would be asleep, you know. And he'd shout from the pulpit, waking up that person beside you there. And then we'd all get on to the train, all hungry. They called it the hungry train. And some of these crowds from Dublin there, like the Franciscans and the Redemptorists and all those crowds, they'd bring pilgrimages. And then, you see, you couldn't eat anything after 12 o'clock the following night.
So this is what you do? This is your job, driving the boat, isn't it?
This is my job, yeah.
And preparing for the busy June season?
Yeah, starting up on Tuesday. Tuesday is the 2-day pilgrimage.
Purgatorium, Sancti Patrici reads the steel archway we travel under to reach Lough Derg. The island reveals itself, its true nature. It briefly takes our breath. It's not unlike a fortress. 3 days before the start of the pilgrimage, the reception is empty of people. Some phone calls later, a boat engine is heard starting in the distance. A diesel engine now does the job of 12 men. First impressions couldn't be any different from what we'd expected. The sun is warm on our skin and the breeze is fresh. The place is quiet. In effect, we are alone. In the same way I try to imagine our abandoned train line in its former glory, I try to imagine the 300 pilgrims who will be here in 3 days' time. Barefoot, hungry, tired. But despite this, we'll leave here at the end of 3 days with whatever they were looking for. We shed our well-worn boots, and far from being penance, the sun-kissed slabs energise our souls.
Finished, I suppose, 1957.
It's terrible, isn't it? All those trains gone.
Donal is one of the many helpful guides at Lough Derg.
We have people from Australia, America, Europe, the UK. We have quite a lot of visitors from each year. Some of the African countries as well. Brazil, Argentina. So they do come from from quite a distance.
In terms of age group, what would be the youngest pilgrim and maybe...
15. 15 is the age limit. We don't go any lower than that, really, because of kind of health maybe restrictions and just... You kind of, when you're younger than that, you can't really maybe appreciate what Lochdaig's really all about. And
what in terms then an upper age limit is, as old as you feel?
As old as, basically, yes, as old as you feel that you're able to meet the challenges of the pilgrimage, I suppose. You know, we have people that come and they're well into their 80s. So you just, if they're able in themselves to do it, they're not turned away. So.
Fair play to them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We'll go for a wander and see what they...
Thanks for that.
No, thanks very much.
Appreciate it. So, with the sun shining, the stone was nice and warm. I had to say I had this vision of a cold, wet stone and stubbing your toenails. And this isn't bad at all now, but I'm sure on a cold, wet day it's a lot different.
I think we'll go for a walk around the basilica in our bare feet and see how we've stood up to the test of Lochdaig.
There's some... Ow, thistles. Jesus. Sorry, I shouldn't be saying, taking the Lord's name in vain.
Before we leave the island, a story is recounted to us. Shortly after the closure of the Irish North and the lifting of the tracks, a solitary pilgrim made his way along the very same cuttings and embankments to Lochdaig on his own personal pilgrimage. Maybe he knew what was being lost, in a way most of us don't. We only realise it after the fact.
So we are on our way to Balik, and we've been walking for about 4 miles. About 4 miles so far cross country, and some beautiful sections through stone that was blasted either side to make way in. And we've come to a gorgeous bridge here with ornamental wrought iron. And my God, we have sections of a railway. This is extraordinary. This is really, 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 really cool. It's an amazing landscape here. We're up in an embankment, a really, really, really tall embankment. We're kind of converging with the road here. Figure of eight wrought iron work either side of this bridge. And we're actually... We do well to walk actually on the middle of it, on the iron or the steel beams, because... That wood that we were walking on, these sleepers, is kind of, I'd imagine they could be quite rotten. Jeez, it's a long way down if you did go for a tumble.
You're itching to walk across it.
Yeah. Let me have a look at it from this angle.
To cross or not to cross, Brian?
I'll cross.
You sure it's not going to be like the Cassandra crossing or anything like that
then? No, we'll be 100%. There's underneath these is steel pillars. Yeah, there is.
I love the way you say that as you start across.
Just looking, trying to read the inscription on some of the steel bits that are forged here. I think that was dated 1912. You see, the trees have actually taken root on the middle of the bridge. They're actually growing on timber. Onward. And across the frontier. So, it's somewhat typical of this country. One of the most beautiful settings we've come to in the whole walk. Like a mini canyon. We come to a railway bridge, and somebody has used it as a dump. All sorts of waste. Charming. An inventory of an Irish dump on the Irish North Line closed in 1958, and we have the following items dumped: a tricycle, a toaster, a wheelbarrow, a bicycle, an ironing board, a door, a bread bin, some tins, a coal bunker, some oil drums, plenty of black bags, and some empty buckets. Ballyshannon. The sea comes into view where the Erne empties into Donegal Bay. Excitement and anticipation for those on the Bundoran Express. The same for us, despite our fatigue. Tiring like us, here the line seems to give up. Out of Ballyshannon, the bypasses road roughshod over our Irish north. It fades in parts so much as to lead us to question the path the train took. A solitary, erratic rail bridge cropping out of the bypass, as if pushed by some glacier, confirms its route. We stand under its arch, traffic zooming, screaming its message. You belong to the past. You're obsolete. The bridge has stood 100 years. The road 10.
This is a tunnel. This is the tunnel that Dan Kerr said. You had to have your move made. If there was a particular girl you fancied, you had to be sitting beside her before you came to this point. Because you were plunged into darkness for a very few moments. I'm just going to see from up here. Again, probably a bit boggy here, so...
Whoa.
Now, first of all, just to let you know, I'm completely immersed up to my knees in muck here. If you take the equipment,
yeah.
I'll get it out. Now, that's unbelievable.
Okay.
Yeah. Take it.
God knows how deep that goes, like.
You ever seen a cowboy movie and you've seen someone sinking into quicksand and having to stay really still, or they go down and down and down and down? Well, that's just what's occurred to me on the far side of where this tunnel would have came out. It looks just slightly boggy, but you wouldn't guess it to be the quagmire that it is. And from both my knees down, I'm completely covered in the foulest smelling muck. We're walking here and we're on the Bundoran bypass, or the Ballyshannon.
We arrive into Bundoran and it's hard to tell where one housing estate begins and one ends. Higgledy Piggledy goes some way towards describing it. Some unfinished houses, pallets of blocks and corrugated containers stand sentinel, as if time has stood still and a great virus has swept the land. So-called progress is its victim. We've travelled a century and 80 miles in 5 days. We've looked into the minds of pick-wielding men, their every sinew tuned to the task of building the permanent way. All gone now. The drivers and firemen of the steam locomotives. Under their hand, the feel of a living, beating steam engine. Knowing the rhythm of the pistons connected to this giant. All gone now. The passengers. All gone now. Living memory is passing into history. The physical railway is passing into archaeology.
But a lot of crowd used to go to Bundoran and stay on Bundoran and then come back and do luck there before they go home. That's true, after they carried on, I suppose.
was a driver in Bundoran, I'll not tell you who he was, but he got a pious turn and said he would do the island. And he was on the island on the second day anyway, and the priest was going around talking to people, and he recognised him. He said, you're a driver, you see you bringing the train through here, are you doing indeed, Father? And chatted away about one thing or another, and then he looked down, and the priest said to him, you know, he said, you're supposed to do this in your bare feet. This guy had a reputation of washing himself too much. He said, but Father, I am in my bare feet.
And the way it used to thunder past there with the sparks and the smoke and the steam and all that flying out, it was quite scary at times if you didn't get off the track in time. We were never actually burnt, but of course many's a cutting was burnt out because of the smoke and the star and the sparks and that kind of thing. But like, it was a great sight, and it was a very memorable thing too.
And then arriving in Bundoran and never really lived up to its expectations.
the train journey was more...
The train journey was more exciting than the actual destination. And then you could look forward to the journey home as well. So.
Some things stay the same. The same tides ebb. And here and now in Bundoran, the same pleasures await us, as did our express passengers. Stout, black and cold, needs a drinking. There's gambling. Where sand meets water is to be felt underfoot. And the jump into the Atlantic from Rogie Cliff is daring us to be attempted. The express has arrived once more.
If you enjoyed this documentary, you might like to listen to our other Documentary on One productions. Visit rte.ie/docon1.